the New Zealand Business Podcast, brought to you by Guerrilla Technology, your strategic and proactive IT partner.
Peter Beck is the remarkable founder and chief executive of Rocket Lab, one of just a handful of privately funded entities to put rockets into space and satellites into orbit. Thanks to Peter and his team's tenacity, intelligence, and executional excellence, Rocket Lab has not only succeeded at putting multiple rockets into space from New Zealand, the company's valuation has shot well past $1 billion. They've won numerous awards and are now preparing to also launch into space from the United States. And along the way, New Zealand has become the 11th country to reach space. Hi, I'm Paul Spain, founder and CEO at Guerrilla Technology. I'm dedicated to understanding more about how leaders and their organizations succeed, innovate, and disrupt. In this episode of New Zealand Business Podcast, we hear from one of the most focused and strategic leaders I've ever met. Peter Beck has, in just 12 years, made Rocket Lab one of the most exciting companies on and off the planet. And his mission to open access to space to improve life on Earth is now a reality. So let's jump straight into the chat. We had inside Rocket Lab's previous mission control center to learn and gain insights into their achievements.
Great to chat again, Pete.
Oh, my pleasure.
Real privilege to sit down and hear a little bit about your journey and your story. Kind of quite keen to start in the sort of your early days. I understand that you became interested in rockets at a fairly young age. It's sort of, you know, really an interest for you growing up.
Yeah, I mean, the first kind of memory I can have of space was, I don't know how old I was, but probably two or something like that, with my father outside looking at a shooting star. And that for me was really really the beginning of it all. You know, the thought that there's this giant universe out there with stars and planets and you know, who knows what's on them. Really, even at that young age, blew my mind. And it was just very clear from that point onwards that I was going to do something in space.
Wow. And you must have done a fair bit of sky gazing then as a youngster. You had access to.
I mean, I was probably one of the youngest members ever of the Southland Astronomical Society, and I really had no idea what everybody was talking about. But I got to drink tea at the end and listen to really, really fascinating people who were quite who were really passionate about space, and see cool images and hear the latest research that was going on. So certainly well above my pay grade, but really enjoyed that atmosphere.
Wow. So how old do you think you would have been when you started doing that?
The Astronomical Society, probably, I don't know, 8 or 9, something like that.
Yeah.
And
so in terms of schooling and, mm-hmm. and education, you know, how much did you, you know, were you really taking that interest at school? Was it something that sort of worked through, if you were to look back on the projects you did and things like that, was that sort of pretty evident?
Well, I mean, I think that where we've ended up now has been the perfect collision of two passions. One is space and the other is engineering. And, you know, at school, you know, I was building aluminium mountain bikes, and, you know, my final school project for metalwork was, in fact, a car. So, you know, I completely rebuilt a car. So, you know, it was always, you know, very, very engineering focused. And, you know, rockets are one of those things when, you know, you talk about the peak of engineering, the hardest kind of engineering you can do, you know, that you quickly arrive at launch vehicles.
So when do you think was your first thought of building a launch vehicle yourself?
Well, it's hard to pinpoint the time. You know, originally I wanted to go and work for NASA or you know, one of the big aerospace companies. And, you know, everything I did in my career was to, you know, to try and position myself for that. You know, it was about building the rocket. You know, I went over to the US in, when would it have been, 2006? Yeah, 2006. Went over to the US and did a bit of rocket pilgrimage there for a month. And went and visited all the places that I'd been corresponding with and the people I'd been corresponding with. And really it was at the kind of the end of that trip that I realized two things. The first thing that I realized is what I fundamentally wanted to do, which was democratized space was not going to happen in that environment.
So you already had that vision.
Oh yeah,
went,
yeah, yeah, totally.
Something you'd had for some time.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'd been building rockets for, you know, since I was at school. So, you know, there was you know, a constant there. And then the other thing I kind of realized is that what I was doing back at home wasn't significantly different to what these little companies were doing in the Mojave Desert. So those were kind of two realizations, and you know, the formation of Rocket Lab actually occurred at 30,000 feet, halfway between LA and New Zealand on that way home. And when I landed, I decided I had a name, I had everything I needed to do, quit my job and incorporated and went.
Well, it takes a little bit of you know, guts to do that. You must have been, I guess, I mean, that was your trajectory that you were already, you know, set on, so you figured out how to do it, and away you went.
Yep.
Yeah. Now, so take us back to those sort of school years where you were dabbling with rockets. What did that look like? What was your first rocket?
Well, I did quite a lot with steam rockets to start with. They're very safe, comparatively speaking. I mean, you superheat steam, you know, to very high pressures and temperatures, and then, you know, flash the saturated water to steam through a throat. And rubbish performance, like 36 seconds of ISP, so rubbish performance.
What's ISP?
It's a specific impulse. It's the measure of performance of a rocket.
Okay.
So how much propellant you burn to produce the thrust you generate over time. To give you a comparison to that, you know, Electron, an upper stage engine, is like 320 seconds of ISP. So, you know, we're talking big steps here.
Yeah.
But then I got into hydrogen peroxide rocket engines, so both in monopropellants and bipropellants, and liquid propellant, and then I did hybrids and solids, and really, you know, from an engine perspective, did it all.
And so who were you doing this with? Were there other people around with similar interests, or were you doing this on your own?
Yeah. I mean, I built a significant workshop and of my own, and just went to it.
And how did you learn? What were your sources of information?
Well, I mean, engineering is engineering, and whether you're building a washing machine or a rocket engine, you know, certain fundamentals apply. Like, you can't bend physics. But, you know, there's a lot of information from books and from people, and just trying it, just actually running experiments and understanding. And, you know, that's one thing that I was always very, very careful with. You know, when you're dealing with energetic propellants and things like that, there's no room for she'll be right. So, you know, I was always very methodical in the way that I conducted my research. So there was never, you know, by the time I got to the point of a test fire, it was never sort of, you know, just close your eyes and hope for the best. There was some, you know, degree of confidence there and understanding of the potential energies and safe working distances and all those things.
And so how successful, you know, were you with those things in those younger years?
It depends on what you measure as success is, really.
What worked? What, you know? How often did you sort of? How did you see? You know, what sort of failures did you see? What did those things teach you?
Sure. I mean, when things really kicked into a high gear when I started doing my apprenticeship at Fisher & Paykel in Dunedin as a tool and die maker, because all of a sudden I had this massive resource of engineering knowledge, of workshop. But also the design office. You know, I had CAD, I had finite element analysis, I had all of these tools available to me. So it was like taking what I'd learned and just putting it on steroids. Like, it was a huge, you know, resources to be able to use. And then happened once again when I went, you know, ultimately went and worked for a government research institute, is I had, you know, the highest possible level of tools to be able to research and analyze and design. And you know, this would all take place after hours, of course.
So you must have been working some long hours if you added together what at that stage was sort of your hobby, I suppose.
Oh, yeah.
Alongside your day job, right?
That's been consistent my entire life. I mean, that's just the way I operate. But yeah, I mean, we'd do the second shift on rockets and the first shift to pay for the second shift.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's probably a common story there for, you know, a lot of people. You know, I guess in terms of the rest of your story is, you know, probably quite different to the norm. So walk us through those first two jobs and you know, how did you end up at Fisher & Paykel? Mm. You didn't go through university, but you obviously had what it took from their perspective to take you on.
Yeah, I mean, I started off as an apprentice tool and die maker, and really enjoyed that because my master plan was always to get a good grounding in the trades, and take up a precision trade, because I believe that if you have very good practical skills and you're able to top that off with very good academic skills, then you can do a lot. It's great to be able to design something. It's even better if you can just whip down and make it. And for me, you have to realise it's always about the rocket. So. That was certainly always the plan, but opportunities kept presenting themselves such that I never formally finished or did that academic bit. But I mean, whether you learn about how a shaft breaks at university or learn how a shaft breaks by breaking a shaft, it doesn't actually matter. You learn the same thing.
Yeah, that's great. And so then on to the moving on from Fisher & Paykel, what was it that sort of drew you onto that next role? What did that consist of?
Well, I mean, the next role was I was a project engineer for a super yacht company, building a 123-foot super yacht. And that was a great learning opportunity. I learned a lot about leadership, learned a lot about big complex systems, learned a lot about deadlines. So it was really a fantastic experience to take a big project like that and try and pull everything together. So that was it was a important part of my life.
Looking back, can you think of what particular leadership lessons really stuck with you?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, it's all about the people. I think that's the first thing to remember. You can have all the spreadsheets you want in the world, but it's actually the guys down the floor that have to execute it. So that was probably the biggest lesson that I took out of all that.
Hmm. And what about the project management and the deadlines and managing those things? Because different teams and different leaders can vary wildly sometimes with effectively very similar levels of resource. They can get quite different outcomes. Mm. What did you learn from those perspectives?
I learned that I didn't know a lot. To be perfectly honest, and I'm still learning today. I think every leader is. If you think you know it all, then you're really wrong. But certainly in those early years, the importance of building the teams and the culture, so that people want to win.
Mm-hmm. And so how long did that last? The super yacht work?
I can't remember. Couple of years, I think.
And then moving on from that.
Yeah, I was trying to solve a problem in the back of the super yacht. It always found it ironic that we had to save weight by making titanium doorknobs for the cabinetry, but at the back of the boat we pour like 20 tons of sand in it to suppress the sound. And there's got to be an easier way to suppress the sound than just mass. So it was looking into that and doing a lot of analysis to try and figure out ways that to fix that problem that I bumped into the guys at Industrial Research and ultimately applied for a job there.
Right. Did you ever solve the challenge of
very straightforward challenge. You've got an engine that operates in a very narrow RPM range. You've got propellers with a distinct number of blades. So if you look at the spectrum they actually have to bandpass there, it's quite a simple problem.
So were you happy with the results? That,
no, we filled it full of sand.
Oh, okay. So you weren't able to actually use it in that case.
But it wasn't actually that difficult a problem to solve.
Yeah. Okay. Good. And so what was that role with Industrial Research? What did that look like?
So I think my official title was a research engineer, but did a lot of commercial work. So going out into industry where things had broken or. Having problems, things that their engineers couldn't solve. You come out and instrument things and try and actually get down to the root cause and ascertain what the problem was. So did a fair bit of that, and also the other probably 50% of my job is dedicated to superconductors, but not the electrical side of superconductors, the mechanical side of superconductors. So how can you cut and form ceramic crystals that are sort of a few microns thick of superconducting materials?
So who were the sort of companies or entities that were were drawing on your skills? Who were you working with?
At IRL?
Yeah.
Oh, it was a vast yeah. range of stuff. You know, yeah. we did wind turbine stuff, train stuff, all sorts of. It was really exciting work, actually, because you generally were called in when there was a big problem and there was high stakes and everybody else had thrown everything they had at it and couldn't figure it out. And you'd have to go in there and try and figure it out. I really enjoyed it.
So was this the sort of, you know, I guess what is common in a country like New Zealand is that, people don't always sort of drill down and, you know, focus super deep. You know, you were dealing with some challenges that seemed like they were, probably broad to a degree, certainly across a lot of different sectors.
Mm.
So how was that for you in terms of learning? You must have...
Oh, I learned a tremendous amount. I mean, you know, the time, like I say, there was a couple of inflection points in my life where things really got, a massive inflection point. And working at, you know, the Crown Research Institute with the team there, I mean, those guys are the most incredible guys. I just learned so much, and their willingness to share their knowledge was just phenomenal. Like, you have the best researchers and scientists in the country, and it's very easy to, you know, to just sort of focus on your little thing. When an annoying person comes along and say, hey, I've got this acoustic resonance problem in a combustion chamber in my rocket engine, and actually be able to talk to a guy that can dig really deep and explain to you what's going on is hugely, hugely beneficial. And they were just so supportive.
So when you look back, how important do you think that time was in terms of helping you understand the sort of people that you would need to work with and bring onto the team for Rocket Lab?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of think that there's definitely a good aspect to that, but I kind of see those years as like an academic download. Just a mass pouring of knowledge and skills and experiences and learning. And then starting your own company and raising capital and all those things are a totally different set of skill sets that nobody can teach.
So what was the hardest thing during that period? Because, you know, you obviously had this vision in terms of Rocket Lab, although you hadn't, you know, maybe defined exactly what that looked like. Mm. What was hard about your work prior to Rocket Lab?
How do you mean hard?
What were the challenges in, you know, IRL, for instance? What were the challenges sort of working there, or was it there was nothing that sort of?
Oh, I loved it.
Yeah.
Oh, I absolutely loved it. I mean, every place I've worked, I've loved.
Yeah.
If I didn't love it, I wouldn't work there. But I'm just always fortunate that I've always gone to places where the work has been fantastic, the people have been fantastic, and you have to temper that with the fact that I'm there to fulfill my requirements as an employee. Secondary, I'm there to extract as much knowledge and expertise and experience as I can. And the places that I've been, you know, privileged enough to work have just fulfilled that need. So,
right. So that vision was very clear for you in terms of what you wanted to get out of it.
I was filling the cans with everything I need.
Yeah,
to go on my big trip. Totally.
Yeah. So there wasn't too much that would stress you out in that environment or not. I guess it's sometimes through those more, you know, challenging times that you pick up and learn things along the way.
Oh, you know, no, there was no shortage of stress. I mean, when some guys got a broken piece of gear and their factory stopped and then nobody knows why, I mean, that's real stress. That's real economic drivers. I wouldn't say it was low stress. I'm not a low stress person. I like to get shit done, but it was just a great opportunity to learn.
Mm-hmm. And then it was from there that you headed off to the US after period there.
Yeah. So I went to the US and then literally came back with Rocket Lab.
What were the places that you visited? How many spots were there to go to?
Yeah, I went and saw the guys at JPL at NASA and the Rocketdyne factory at Conger Park and Lockheed guys and all the Scale Composites team out at Mojave and all the little shops out at Mojave Desert and I had a really good look around.
So Mojave Desert, that must be an interesting place to visit because there are, lots of little shops. Mm. These are the people that you sort of look to as leading the way and so on. Yet a lot of them aren't, particularly big facilities, are they?
Yeah, no, they're not. I mean, that's what I say. That was one of the key things that prompted me to start Rocket Lab is I held everybody there and in high esteem, and they should be. But when I actually went there and saw their stuff, saw the problems that they were working to solve, saw their equipment, they had the same laptop and the same pressure transducers, the same data acquisition systems, solving the same problems. So there wasn't really a giant disparity between what was going on there and what was going on back in New Zealand.
Right. And I'm also curious about this flight back because certainly for me the flights between Auckland and North America can just be there's no internet or mm-hmm. that's just changed in recent times, but often after some time in the US you just get some great thinking on a flight. Mm. Even heading the way over. So walk us through what that was, how quickly all of that came together for you and what were the conclusions that you came up with?
Well, I mean, the first half of the flight I was thinking, gee, this isn't how I thought it was going to be. The second half of the flight was, okay, let's do it the way we think it should be. And it's not really much more of an exciting story than that, quite frankly. Doodled some logos on a napkin, a little white Air New Zealand napkin, and that was that.
So what you thought it should be, paint that picture of what you were thinking. What were you thinking of Rocket Lab at that stage? Were you thinking of, and I'm presuming you weren't thinking of something to go that would build a rocket to go to Mars, because I don't think that's one of your particular interests. What were you thinking of at that stage? Is it where we're at now in the business, or was it
I mean, it always has and always will be about accessing space. I mean, once you can access a domain, you can start to innovate in it. Right now we really can't access space in any kind of significant scaled way. And we started off with sounding rockets to try and build credibility and capability, but also to try and solve a need of actually just getting some microgravity time for some researchers. So it's always been about access to space, and everything the company's ever done throughout its history has been about how can we create an opportunity for people to go use space to create technologies and solutions for the betterment of everybody down on Earth. There's nothing that's ever been changed from there.
Right.
Yeah. It's pretty boring, really.
Smaller things that you were launching and testing initially, there was one sort of handheld type size for forestry. Yep. Tell us about that and how that fitted into the picture.
Well, it was all about building capability and understanding. Like, that taught us an awful lot about GNC, guidance, navigation, and control. We had to develop that product to very stringent standards, water immersion, dust immersion, all of those kinds of standards. And it was very much about building capability and credibility. And, the road is always windy. It's never a straight line. And sometimes you've got to go around a few bends to build some of these things, some of these elements, in order to get to the end point.
Mm. Now, all of these things take money.
Mm-hmm.
And I presume some of these things that you were working on probably didn't generate more than the costs that in terms of the return on investment. Mm-hmm. But walk us through how you went from getting off that plane,
mm-hmm.
and how long did it take you to get your first funding, and what did that story look like?
Yeah, I mean, basically, I'd incorporated Rocket Lab, and I, you know, started doing a lot of design work, and yeah, everything kind of lined up. And then I heard a guy on the radio by the name of Mark Rocket, and he had renamed himself Mark Rocket. And I thought, here's a guy that's clearly passionate about space. And so I contacted Mark, and he shared my vision. And he ultimately made a small investment into the company, which started the whole thing along.
Right. This was what, about 2007?
Yep.
Yeah. Yep. And so you've got an initial investment there to help you along. Mm. Were you able to get any other funding locally? Because I know you've talked about challenges of funding this sort of thing from a New Zealand perspective. Yep. What else did you manage to get in terms of local
well,
funding?
Well, I mean, we from 2007 to 2009, we kind of bootstrapped and funded through various mechanisms until we launched our Tier 1, which is our first suborbital launch vehicle. And then between 2009 and 2013, we did a lot of contracts for DARPA and for Lockheed Martin and built credibility and capability that way, and did things like that, an instantized project you're talking about. Mm. So we kind of bootstrapped it. And then in 2013, we had a very successful technology demonstrator, and it was a kind of a left or right. Do we go left and potentially sell our business or be acquired to a defense contractor, or do we try and go and raise a capital in Silicon Valley? And for me, I mean, that's what I set the company out to do. So that's the direction I ran in.
Mm. How hard did you find the fundraising process? Even that an initial one with Mark Rocket in New Zealand.
Yep.
What does that process sort of look like? Obviously, that must have varied from stage to stage. What did it look like initially?
I would love to say that it's better now than it was then, but that would be a lie. In fact, I think it's probably worse. I think the state of venture capital and the opportunities that New Zealand entrepreneurs have is just woeful. It's terrible. And that's something that I'm trying to work on adjacently to Rocket Lab. But for me, it was this project is immense project, and it's about fundamentally changing a domain and having a big impact on the world. So there was only ever going to be one kind of investor that was going to be suitable for this kind of project, and that is Tier 1 Silicon Valley guys that look for the next Google and the next Facebook. That in order to get even a meeting with them, you need to demonstrate a clear path to a billion-dollar company, and it has to have a significant impact on the planet. If you can't pass those two tests, you don't even get in the door.
So what did it take for you, and how long did you think it would take you to get to that point where the doors were going to be open? Did that sort of pan out how you thought it would, or was it a lot more challenging?
No, I mean, I never really think back and think, oh boy, that was challenging. And I mean, you just have to accept that everything is challenging, especially in this business. So I don't really look back and go, well, that was more challenging than that thing. It's just everything is challenging, so let's just get over it. And it's about going after it methodically. If you just turned up in the valley and started shooting wild, then you're going to die. For me, it was I went up to the valley and I gave myself a goal. I said 3 weeks to run out of town or come home with a check. So the first week, I went around all of the companies that had been funded by venture capital in America, some very large ones, some very small ones, and very quickly got the lowdown on who's good and who's not so good. But also I got the lowdown of how it works, because it's no different to understanding a piece of machinery. You need to lift the hood and understand how it works before you can go and play with it. So it was exactly like that in Silicon Valley. Lift the hood, see how it all works. And then the next 2 weeks really focused on the meetings that I wanted to have, and I only talked to three people up there,
right?
In the end.
So that first week, how ready were others to share their experiences and what relationships had worked? How did you make that happen to start with?
I think my view on people is they're generally good, and people generally want to help. It's kind of like a nucleation point in a pond of ice. Once it starts to nucleate, then the ice just starts to grow and spread and spread. And then once you find that one person that that has a little bit of knowledge, they introduce you to the next person, next person, next person. And, you know, in the space of a week, you have a pretty, if you just don't sleep, you can have a pretty good idea of what's going on in that area. I mean, you're no expert and you're green as anything, but you know enough to be dangerous.
Excuse the interruption, but if, like me, you're always looking to give your team an edge with the best tools for success, then you'll be interested in this New Zealand Business Podcast special we have for you from our sponsors, Process Street and Guerrilla Technology. Process Street is the platform we've been using at Guerrilla to capture our business processes, to continually improve them, increase client satisfaction, and improve our overall operational excellence. Today, our team deliver the most consistent results we've ever had, thanks in part to the tool of Process Street. If you'd like to find out how Process Street can help you and improve your business operations, and you'd like an ongoing 10% discount for life plus a free trial, just visit nzbusinesspodcast.com/processstreet. Now let's get back to the chat with Peter Beck.
Talk us through a little bit more around that journey from the sort of smaller rockets. You obviously funding came on board. What were the points at which you got plugged in to getting work from the US? Of course you've got NASA and others that you've worked with. How did those things come about?
Well, I mean, once again, I kind of see business especially as like a game of chess, and you have to make sure all your pieces are in the right place. And sometimes you'll make some moves that will be seemingly wasteful and, to your opponent, even unsensical. But, I've had thousands upon thousands of meetings with people that had no general outcome whatsoever. But one day you turn up and the guy that's in the room who's a decision maker knows the guy that you've had the meeting with who said that you're a great guy. So so you have to do a lot of work, I think, is what it comes down to. And you have to be strategic, but also you just have to do a lot of work.
Now, looking at that, some people get sort of caught up in at what stage do we go and, meet with people and knock on doors? Do you wait until you've got everything perfect and absolutely, sorted? Mm-hmm. Or do you just start going out and doing those? And obviously you're very strategic around how you timed those things.
Yep.
Did you have some, challenging calls there to make around when was the right time to meet with different people, or because you were moving at such a pace anyway, you already had some great runs on the board to talk about in every case anyway?
No, I think that's very important. I mean, I wouldn't have gone to Silicon Valley if we hadn't done all of those things prior, because there's no way that you would have been successful. So, Silicon Valley was in my crosshairs for a long time, but we had to do a lot of work, chew a lot of glass before it was the right time. And it's like that with anything is sometimes you have to hurry up and wait is kind of the thing to do.
Yeah.
So it's strategy is, and the right approach is incredibly important. A lot of these meetings you have one chance at. Especially in Silicon Valley, you'll go to a partnership meeting, you'll pitch your company or your idea, and in that 20 minutes, that partnership will decide if they're going to invest in you or not. So it's not like a long, drawn-out process over time. It's literally, in often cases, 20 minutes, and you're either in or you're out.
Yeah, that's pretty full-on. You want to make sure you're pretty well prepared for those meetings.
Absolutely.
You can't drop anything, can you, in that case?
But, I mean, this is the industry we're in.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no second chance of the rockets either. You have to make sure you're 100% prepared.
What support did you have around you in terms of advisors and others that were able to help you through in these processes?
Not really. I mean, anybody. Not any kind of singular focused person. I mean, like I mentioned before, I just went up to the valley and spoke to everybody. If you talk to people in New Zealand about what it's like raising money in Silicon Valley, they'll tell you, oh, it's the sharks and it's terrible and you're going to get eaten alive, and sometimes it's better to just learn yourself and go up there.
So what was it that clarified the timing was right for you to go for funding? This was tied in with the Electron?
We raised the funding to fund to do Electron. We had reached a point in time where we had demonstrated some pretty tricky stuff. And a lot of people knew that we had demonstrated some pretty tricky stuff. So when it came to, you know, due diligence, they would go and talk to people and they already knew about us and we already had a reputation. So there was a lot of work had to be done before you reach that point where you've got the credibility.
Right. But in terms of presenting, were you presenting the Electron ideas? Is that what you were talking about at that stage?
Yeah.
That's very, very interesting. So in terms of going through and seeking that funding, you've now got, you know, quite a range of investors on board. That's, you know, you've had the initial with Cosler. How's that sort of led on from there? You've had, what does that story look like?
Well, I mean, building your board and your investors and your shareholders is no different to building a high performance engineering team. You need the best people you can get. And, you know, for me, it's always been about who is the most strategic person, the best people I can bring into the company to build the company, rather than who's got the best deal. So if you look at our board, you know, it's a superstar board. You've got Sven from Kozler. You've got David Cohen from Bessemer. I mean, they made a TV show about him. And you've got Matt Ocko from Data Collective, and Scott Smith, who's the COO of Iridium, the largest satellite constellation on orbit. So, it's really been about building the best team everywhere.
Now, it seems like that, you know, these things are always premeditated for you. You've got a pretty good idea up front, you know, what you want before you get there. Is this the way you've always been? You've always been, you know, wired to figure these things out. You know, it doesn't seem as though there are things that happen by chance, but it seems like, you know, you've got a pretty clear vision, and you've had a very clear vision for a very long time.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's key. I mean, you know, there's always lucky things that happen, but in a lot of senses, you can also make your own luck as well. That's kind of the most important thing, I think, in undertaking an engineering project like this or building a company like this, is if you're kind of wafting in the wind, then you're never going to get there. This has to be a clear focal point.
So how would you describe making your own luck for you?
Goodness. Well, I mean, you know, you can engineer, you know, certain circumstances. You know, a good example is on a due diligence process. You know, they one of the investors reached out to NASA and they formed a team of three people, and I knew two of them. So, you know, it's about you know, having those, like I said before, having literally thousands of meetings and building the credibility of your company. Such that the day that you need those people in those meetings, that they're there.
Mm. Now, can you share with us some of the challenges that there have been, you know, from an engineering perspective, mm-hmm. from a leadership perspective? Mm-hmm. You know, every organisation, you know, goes through these things.
Mm-hmm.
From an outside perspective, it looks as though that, you know, there's very little that goes wrong, mm-hmm. For you. But I think, you know, inside there's always things that are maybe tougher than you expect, or unexpected things that come along. What can you share?
Well, I mean, building a rocket is generally considered something that a nation does, or a government does, with a nation of resource and a nation of capital. So that's...
Over quite a long period, right?
Yeah, over a long period of time, over a decade generally. There's lots of learnings that go on, but, you know, sometimes you learn way more from a failure than you actually do from a success, because if it's something that's a success, you generally don't look too deeply into it. If it's a failure, then you need to look really, really deeply into it. There's the challenges. Going doing this is probably the biggest barrier to the entry of the market you could possibly imagine, not only from an engineering standpoint, from a regulatory standpoint, and from an infrastructure standpoint. I mean, from an engineering standpoint, 1.5% of the rocket's mass is the satellite. So what that means, if you're a fraction of a percent out on mass, guidance, propulsion, performance, gas, anything, you've just made a giant firework and you get absolutely nothing to orbit. So the margins, you know, in this game are just incredibly, incredibly tight. So, you know, that's it. That's a huge challenge. And then from a regulatory standpoint, there's a hugely, hugely stringent regulatory environment that we have to operate in under. And those regulations were created at a time where nobody in their right mind ever anticipated a commercial company going to space. That's just crazy talk. Like, it's governments that go to space. We might have the odd commercial payload on board, but let's just build this whole regulatory regime for governments and share it between governments. And then, you know, then you have people like us and others in the industry that come along, and that's a very, you know, challenging regulatory piece. And then there's infrastructure. I mean, we had to build our own launch site. We had to build tracking stations, and we have tracking stations on remote islands in the Pacific. We have some in Europe. They're dotted all around the world. Just the sheer infrastructure build is enormous. I mean, there's a fair chunk of the team here are dedicated to just building roads and jigs and fixtures and equipment and plant just to support all the operations.
Now, looking at all those sorts of things, I mean, you know, drilling down just into one of those pieces, huge challenges to make it work, to get the results that you want. Mm. But you need to line all of these things up, and all of them need to work.
And all have right. to happen at the same time.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep.
How do you think has operating, as a smallish private firm based between Auckland and California, been in your favour versus, say, being a big government entity?
Well, I mean, we can move quickly, and we don't sit there studying stuff. We'll make a decision, and if it's a wrong decision, that's okay. But at least, you know, we've made a decision, and if it's a wrong decision, we'll go back and change a decision. And I think those two things are the most important things: is the ability to make a decision quickly, and also the ability to admit that your decision was wrong, and that's okay.
What sort of pressures have you felt from the funding and finance side? Because, you know, I guess often startups will throw a whole lot of money at something. They'll burn through all the cash. Mm-hmm. They won't get the results that they wanted. Yep. And look, the doors are shut and that business is, you know, gone.
Yep.
And then, you know, there's other cases where maybe, there's all sorts of sort of scenarios in terms of, whether it's they're, you know, too fast on the cash burn or some fundamental mistakes that get made in the business along the way that end up derailing it. Mm-hmm. What sort of pressure does that put on you, and you know, how have you handled it when something's really maybe gone off the tracks? You've been looking and thinking, well, are we still going to be here? Are we going to be able to pay everybody in 6 months? Have you had those types of scenarios?
Well, you've just described a very standard startup. I mean, every startup company goes through those things. Mm. But, you know, it's about hitting goals. You know, it's important to tie those goals to milestones that you can fund against. For our first A round of funding, we said what we're going to do is we're going to build a carbon composite tank where we're going to retire the risk around electric turbo pumps and 3D printed rocket engines. And we did that. We hot-fired rocket engines and we built tanks. We didn't mess around with GNC or anything else. You know, we retired the high-risk items, which put us in a very strong position to go and raise the next bunch of capital. Where it's, you know, there's a myriad of failings that, you know, that occur in a startup, but the number one is focus. The number one thing that kills a startup is focus, because they'll start working on something and an opportunity will come along and they'll say, oh, this is an interesting opportunity, maybe we'll just pivot into this a little bit and just get a little bit down that. Then they realize that was way harder than they thought, and then they go back to their core mission, and by the time it's all too late.
Right.
I mean, one thing that nobody can accuse Rocket Lab of is not being focused. We have been laser focused on one thing only, and you know, it stood us in good stead.
What is it that you've enjoyed most around the journey along the way?
Working with amazing people. I mean, most people probably expect me to say, oh, launching a rocket and putting on orbit. It's not actually the truth. That's a great, great outcome, but it's the outcome of working with great, great people.
And how do you find those people? What are the techniques that you follow? Because you've obviously got superstars right across your team. You know, every single direction, you seem to have incredibly talented people. How do you go about, you know, enticing them to come on board?
Yep.
What do you do to make sure you're not hiring duds? You know, that you're hiring people that are going to be a real good fit?
Well, I mean, A players attract A players. So, I mean, the one thing that I've refused to give in on is the quality of people that we bring in. And sometimes people just, you know, some of our managers want a pulse. I refuse to hire a pulse. No matter what role you're in within this company, you're the best that there is within that role. And like I say, A players attract A players. If you build a very high-performing team, then other high-performing people want to join a high-performing team. If you've got a rubbish team, then it's very hard to attract high-performing people to a rubbish team.
Now, being in a real niche space, is it hard to bring those people to New Zealand if they're not already here?
Not really. It's just there's not many people, full stop. You know, we have people from all around the world here. We have, you know, Germans and Brazilians and all different. We're like the UN of the rocket industry. And it takes a lot for someone to give up their job at the European Space Agency, pack up their wife and children, come to New Zealand, and join a startup that may or may not succeed back then. So you know, it's self-selecting. Like, it's you attract the best, and like I say, it's just self-selecting.
To wrap up, what would you say have been, you know, the two or three key things to, you know, your success as an innovative company and as an innovative leader?
Well, I think one is having a big idea and a clear vision and going after it. I think that's important. You know, I said before, hiring the right people. I mean, that your people are your company. Not your logo or whatever HR says your company is. It's actually the people that are in your company are your company. So hiring fantastic people is really, really critical. And I think the last one, which we've also talked about, is focus. Is you know, just being absolutely mindly bloody about the focus of what you're here to do and what you're not here to do.
Has that been hard for you to stay focused?
No. Not really, because, I mean, the end prize here is so enormous. You know, if we're able to actually, you know, create regular access to space, the world becomes a very different place, and we actually, you know, we can actually influence many, many people's lives. And a satellite is one of these unique things that that humans make. And although it's a machine that actually holds the record for touching and influencing the most amount of people in the world, because you can create one weather satellite and it provides weather to New Zealand. 10 minutes later, that same satellite's providing weather to Australia. 20 minutes later, it's providing weather to North America. You know, 40 minutes later, it's over Africa and providing weather to Africa. So that one little spacecraft literally influences billions of people's lives, and there's nothing else that a human can make that has that effect.
Wow, it would be an understatement to say that Peter Beck and Rocket Lab's story so far is incredible. Look, I'd love to hear what inspiration you took away from the insights that Peter shared, and of course, any actions that you'll be taking as a result. Now, you can reach me, Paul Spain, via LinkedIn. Feel free to connect there with a note letting me know you're a New Zealand Business Podcast listener, or you can email me, paul.spain@gorillahq.com. And if your organisation wants to step up or make your own luck, as Peter Beck says, then I'd be honoured to assist. My team at Gorilla Technology love helping those who wish to improve their technology systems, business operations, or to refresh their strategy. Gorilla Technology's purpose is to help people and organisations succeed through great use of technology. So if you believe leveraging technology is a smart way to move your business forward, then the Gorilla team would be honoured to be a part of that journey forwards, even if you're just starting out. And don't forget our special offer on Process Street, which you can sign up for at nzbusinesspodcast.com/processstreet. You'll get access to a free trial, a 10% discount for life, and of course you can get in touch with the Guerrilla team if you need some consulting help with getting up and running on Process Street. And look, if you haven't heard all our other episodes, then there's an amazing collection there at the NZ Business Podcast site. We've got my chat with Rod Drury, founder at Xero, warehouse founder and Rocket Lab investor Sir Stephen Tindall, former All Blacks coach Sir Graham Henry, Chris Heslip of Pushpay is there, amongst a whole bunch more. So look, we look forward to catching you again for the next New Zealand Business Podcast. This is Paul Spain signing out.
The New Zealand Business Podcast, brought to you by Guerrilla Technology, your strategic and proactive IT partner.